Good afternoon. I really feel privileged to be here and to share with you what I've learned over a long period of research and writing about money and banking and the problems with our economic system. The economists will tell us that the recession is over, but I think anybody who has any sense knows better. The questions that I want to address today are these. What's happened to the global economy and financial infrastructure over the past 3 years? What are the underlying causes of the current financial crisis? What are the near-term and long-term prospects? And when will the economy get back to normal? What are the emerging challenges, patterns, and opportunities? I think it's pretty evident that we're facing a mega crisis, that there are a number of things converging together at this time that are challenging us to change the way we do things. We've got climate change, the end of cheap oil, resource depletion, pollution, financial disruption that we've seen over the last few years, and general institutional failure. Our healthcare system fails to provide health, our educational system fails to educate, our food system is increasingly suspect and subject to failure. Over the last several decades, I've been looking into root causes. I've tried to figure out why do we have these recurrent problems in the world, problems of starvation amidst plenty, recurrent wars and strife, and all kinds of difficulties. And I came up with seven areas that I think are in urgent need of restructuring. I put these on one of my websites about 15 years ago. They come down to these: banking and finance, land, ownership, tenure, and use, corporate personhood and power, technology and public policy, government and law, taxation and public revenue. These are all things that need deep exploration and massive change. But at the center of all these, and what seems to be the elephant in the living room, is the money system. How is money created? What is money? And how does it come into existence? Who controls it? Well, what I've discovered is that the political money regime centralizes power and concentrates wealth. And it was designed to do that. In the process, it undermines popular government. It forces artificial growth. There is a debt imperative that's built into this money system, which creates a growth imperative. Now, economists always talk about growth. And growth is the thing that seems to be the sacred cow. But why do we have to have continuous growth? It's not just a matter of growth supposedly adding to the quality of life. It's a matter of the money system demanding growth in order to continue. This system erodes the social fabric and destroys the environment. The fact is that money is kept artificially scarce. It's misallocated, and it's expensive. What we've been seeing in recent years is a systemic failure of conventional money and banking. The political money system is actually shaking itself apart. The bubble and bust cycles are becoming ever more extreme, and we've seen an explosive expansion of debt and debasement of money. And all the president's horses and all the president's men are not going to save this system. You know, we've had Treasury secretaries get together with Federal Reserve board members and the major banking companies to try to keep this system going. There was a good frontline program on PBS a couple months ago that I saw. It was called Breaking the Bank, and it basically told how Secretary of the Treasury, then Secretary Geithner, called this meeting together in Washington last September and basically told the bankers what they had to do in order to save the system. We came very close to a total meltdown of the global financial system. So this bubble and bust cycle is one that is fed by the compound interest that's built into the money system. Now, the thing that we have to recognize is that money is simply credit. Bank credit has become more and more unreliable, especially to the small and medium-sized businesses. And the political money system favors the demands of big banks, big corporations, and big government. And the essential elements of this political money monopoly are a credit monopoly. Banking is actually a cartel, and it's headed by a central bank in the United States, that's the Federal Reserve. And the currency of the central bank, Federal Reserve notes in this country, are granted privileged status through legal tender laws. And it's legal tender laws that require us to accept a debased currency in payment, no matter how badly it is abused by the monetary authorities. The system includes the endless expansion of debt because of the interest burden that's put onto each loan that is made by a bank. And the banks must lend either to the private sector or the public sector to keep the system going. So this growth imperative is what we have to contend with. Money has been the primary lever for centralizing power and concentrating wealth. And here are a couple quotes that underline that point. James Garfield was president for just a few months before he was assassinated. He served in Congress prior to being elected president. This was in the 1870s. And he said, "Whoever controls the volume of money in any country is absolute master of all industry and commerce." Now, Garfield should know because he was chairman of the House Banking Committee during his tenure in the House. This other quote by Reginald McKenna, who is the president of the Midland Bank in England, said, "Those who create and issue money and credit direct the policies of government and hold in the hollow of their hands the destiny of the people." So this is really underlining the importance of money to economic development and growth. Now, this is the culprit right here. I want to show you these figures of $1 of debt growing over time at compound interest. Now, you can see that at 6% interest, if you were to take a loan of $1 and not pay it back for 50 years, at the end of that term, you would own $18. You would owe $18. In 200 years, you would owe $115,000. Now, these are long periods of time in terms of human lifetime, but they're not long periods in terms of institutions and governments. Look at the 10% column. This is only a four-point difference. It doesn't seem like a whole lot, but you see how the numbers become truly astronomical just by raising the rate by 4 percentage points. Here's a chart that shows graphically how these numbers increase. And you see the famous hockey stick that Al Gore made famous in his film. We're seeing it repeated over and over again in many different realms today. And here we see it with compound interest, what I call the magic of compound interest. This isn't just theoretical, we're seeing it played out in reality. This shows the growth in total U.S. debt for all sectors from 1965 until 2007. And in 1965, the total debt for all sectors was somewhere around $1 trillion. In 2007, it had grown to something like $52 trillion. And it grew not only in nominal terms, but also in terms of total economic output. In terms of GDP, in 1965, the total debt was about 1.5 times GDP. In 2007, it had grown to 3.5 times GDP. Now, George Soros, the famous billionaire and currency speculator, has projected in his latest writings that debt will go to about 5 times GDP within the next 2 or 3 years. And if any of you saw Chris Martinson's film this morning, he made the case that these official government numbers, GDP and CPI, for example, are manipulated and always stated in a favorable light. So the situation is probably far worse than the official numbers reflect. This chart shows the U.S. government portion of that debt. Again, up to 2007. And this one goes back to 1940. Well, like all exponential growth curves, you can see how it hangs pretty close to the baseline for quite a long time, and then it breaks sharply upward. And this break occurred somewhere around the mid-70s, and it's continued pretty much uninterrupted, except for a couple years there during the Clinton administration, where the budget showed a small surplus. At that time, economists were hailing this surplus as being projected out into the indefinite future. We saw how quickly that turned around. There is something called the debt clock that is in Times Square in New York City, and you can also see it on the web. And latest figures show the total federal government debt at around $11.67 trillion. Now, looking back at 2007, you see it was at $9 trillion just 2 years ago. So in 2 years, we've seen a 30% increase in federal government debt. And the government is projecting an additional $9 trillion in debt over the next 10 years. And you know it's going to be a lot worse than that if the system continues that long. So I said earlier that banks must lend money either into the private sector or the public sector. I've been talking lately about the Credit Commons. Bob made the point about we have to take care of the commons because the commons support life generally. And I've identified another part of the commons that I call the credit commons. When you think about money and the value that is attached to money, it's our belief in it that really gives it value. The common Federal Reserve notes, or the bank deposits that serve as money today, these are all valued by us because we don't know anything better. We don't have any choices, or we think we don't have choices. But the value of a Federal Reserve note is supported by our collective credit. You know, when the government spends money, we are responsible for those debts. When we go into debt to foreign countries, we are responsible for redeeming the dollars that China and other countries hold. And we're responsible by providing goods and services in return for those dollars. So this is a good opportunity to talk about the latest bubble, which was the real estate bubble. Banks were lending into the private sector on the basis of real estate. They were granting mortgages on a basis of anything but due diligence. Former standards in determining creditworthiness were relaxed or totally discarded. So they were taking on all comers and giving mortgages to anyone without regard to their credit standing or without regard to their incomes. So what happened in the process was a lot of new buyers were put into the market, having access to a lot of new money loaned into the circulation by the banks. And this bid up the prices of real estate, in some places up to 3 times their normal value. And so each additional sale, as the prices rose, justified even higher mortgages to be created, meaning more debt burdening the private sector. In many cases, these loans were made on a basis of low initial interest, which would kick in higher interest rate later on. And also, in many cases, loans were made where you could pay interest only, nothing on the principal for a particular period of time. This happened during the lead up to the Great Depression as well. My grandfather owned a house, which he lost. He was paying interest only on his mortgage. And when he lost his job, he couldn't keep up the payments, so the house was foreclosed. So we had this situation with the real estate bubble being fueled by easy credit from the banks. And when people began to default, not being able to service their mortgages, the banks began to foreclose, throwing real estate back on the market, causing prices again to plummet. So every bubble ends in a bust of that sort. And we've had repeated bubbles and busts. And you know, when I was in college, there was no such thing as a student loan. Banks would not give students a loan. You couldn't take a loan to go to college. In fact, my father, he supported a family, a wife and two children, on one job, and it wasn't a very high-paying job. He sent me and my sister through college, and now it takes at least two incomes just to keep a roof over your head and food on the table. So the Credit Commons has been privatized. We've allowed the banking cartel to take control of the Credit Commons so that access to credit can only be done through the banks by applying for loans. So banks decide who gets access and on what terms, and of course they charge interest. Now here's an important part of this story. National governments have extraordinary access to the Credit Commons. And it's by their collusion with the banking interests that they can borrow as much as they wish and virtually never have to repay. How many people think that the $12 trillion in national debt of the United States government is ever going to be repaid? I don't think so either. You know, what they do is when the bonds come due, of course, they repay the bonds, but they replace them with new bonds and add a few more to boot. So the story of the collusive arrangement between politics and finance goes back more than 300 years. The Bank of England was the prototype. In 1694, King William III, who was on the throne at that time, was fighting a war against France. And wars, of course, are very expensive propositions. It takes a lot of resources in order to fight a war. And subjects don't like to have their taxes raised. And if you push that far enough, you face rebellion. So the king was in a dilemma. William Patterson and some of his cohorts came to the king and they said, well, we will give you the money you need to finance the war if you will give us a privilege. And the privilege was basically that the Bank of England would have the power to lend money, banknotes, into circulation and charge interest on them. So this was the deal that was made at that time. The king got as much money as he wanted to fight the war. He was able to run budget deficits because the Bank of England would just create the money needed. And the bank at that time was able to charge interest on loans that it made to the public for whatever purpose. So we have these two parasitic drains on the economy that have been institutionalized, interest and inflation. So we're at a critical juncture in time. And this from the Earth Charter states it very well. We have to realize that we are one human family with one common destiny. We have to protect this Earth that supports all life. Well, I have this notion that we are, as a society, as a civilization, going through a metamorphic change. It's sort of like the change from the caterpillar to the butterfly. And if you think about what caterpillars do, and any of you who have tended a garden probably have seen this for yourself, caterpillars eat and grow. That's basically what they do. They accumulate nutrients. They eat and they grow. I had a garden a few years ago, and one day I went out and I saw that the two chili pepper plants that I had were completely defoliated. And I looked and I saw on the stems there were two of these big tomato hornworms that were hanging out there. So after I dispatched them, I sort of tried to coax those plants back to life. But basically, what happens with the caterpillar is they eat and they grow. And they go through this process called molting, where they'll shed their skin and replace it with a new skin to accommodate their larger size. But eventually this process comes to a stop. There is something in the caterpillar program that brings it to a conclusion. And at that time, the shell hardens, or in the case of silkworms, they spin a cocoon, and then things become quiet for a while. And inside the cocoon, the caterpillar body begins to break down, disintegrates into a nutrient soup. Well, there were, from the beginning, in the caterpillar body, there were cells called imaginal cells or imaginal discs. And these are the cells that begin to multiply and join together into the organs that will constitute the new butterfly. And when that process is complete, then the butterfly cracks out of the shell, spreads its wings, and flies around. And the butterfly behavior is entirely different from the caterpillar behavior. The butterfly sips nectar from flowers, and in the process helps to pollinate them. And you have a symbiotic relationship. And then they have sex, and the butterfly females lay eggs. The eggs hatch into caterpillars, and the cycle begins anew. So I think in society, this is what we're going through. And we're going to see some major adjustments. There is no getting back to normal. You know, George Soros, another thing that he said is that there is no business as usual. This is the end of an era. Now, he may not have meant quite the same thing that I mean, but we are truly at the end of an era. There's been a lot of talk lately about relocalization. How many people have heard of the Transition Towns movement? Yeah, about half. This is a very important movement that started in England, and they've put out an entire handbook on how local communities can make the transition to a sustainable society. Well, relocalization means a shift in power. Right now, we have all the power at the top of the hierarchy, not only in the national government, but also in corporate hierarchies and institutional hierarchies. Relocalization is going to require a shift of power. And if we're going to get any, if we're going to get anywhere at all in shifting power, we have to reclaim the credit commons by reorganizing the exchange function. Now, the primary function of money is to serve as a medium of exchange. And that actually should be its only function. In my first book, Money is Debt, in the third part of that book, I talked about how the functions of money need to be segregated, because we don't use commodities as money anymore. It's not gold and silver, it's all credit. So the medium of exchange, the store of value, and the measure of value all need to be separated and served by different things. So we need to reorganize the exchange function by doing local community currencies and exchange systems. While we're doing that, we have to do a better job of utilizing our existing resources, the existing money that we have. We have to localize our spending, our saving, and our investing. In other words, we have to invest in the butterfly and not the caterpillar. I'd like to say a little bit about what I have worked out as a new paradigm for community development. How we can prepare for a sustainable future and a steady state economy. When you think about the common problems that regional economies have, local producers have to compete with outside producers that enjoy subsidies or political privilege, have easier access to capital, or don't play by the same rules. If you consider the fact that most of our manufacturing has gone offshore over the last two or three decades, American manufacturers are unable to compete because of the subsidies and the different rules that prevail in the countries where our jobs have gone to. Sweatshop labor, for example. Environmental regulations that don't exist or aren't enforced. And special access to capital in places like China, where the government makes capital available to private enterprises. So in the United States and most of the developed world, conventional money is scarce, and the money that comes in to a community goes quickly out again. Local businesses are being starved for credit and capital, while at the same time the government is being lavished with credit to fight the war and to maintain empires around the world. The terms of trade are dictated by outside corporate buyers or sellers who dominate both the markets that they sell into and the markets from which they get their sources of supply. And resources and wealth are siphoned off by absentee owners. So relocalization means building safe harbors. And I use the analogy of the small boat harbor. Bob alluded to the economist's cliche that a rising tide lifts all boats. And the way I put it is, a rising tide may lift all boats, but the tidal wave of globalization smashes all but the biggest. It's as if there's been a systematic program over the last few decades to dismantle all of the seawalls that protect the small boat harbors. So that provides access for the big ships to come in, but it exposes the small and medium-sized enterprises to the turmoil and turbulence of the global economy. So we have to insulate, but not isolate, our local economies to reduce exploitation, to enhance the economic vitality, to enable self-determination, and optimize our community's standard of living and quality of life. Here are some of my prescriptions. Number one is to withdraw from the race to the bottom. The race to the bottom is the attempt to compete with producers in those countries where labor laws are not existent or not enforced, and where pay scales are very low, where environmental regulations don't exist or are not enforced. So instead of doing that, we should invest in our local infrastructure and the enterprises that are already in the community. So we need to reduce our dependence upon imports and export markets. And we do this through a process called import substitution. Now, the economist Jane Jacobs wrote a book years ago called Cities and the Wealth of Nations. And in that book, she made the point that it is not national economies that are salient. It's the cities that are the salient economic entities. And cities develop by this process of import substitution. Initially, they may be bringing in a lot of things from outside, but as they develop, they find ways to produce locally those things that they imported. Now, there will always be some imports and some exports. No community is ever going to be completely self-reliant. But in order to improve the standard of living within a community, you need to engage in this process of import substitution. And you have to produce more for local consumption, less for export. You have to increase the local value added, enhance opportunities for local exchange, and monetize the local value added. Now, this concept of value added, it's when you take raw materials and you manufacture something from those raw materials, you add value by creating a finished product that can then be used. I was in Seattle last week and I gave a talk there, and I used the example of the Boeing airplane company. Boeing brings in components and materials from all over, and they put these together into a product, an airplane, that has a high value. So the Seattle economy has a very high value added. whatever the value added in a community is, you have to find a way to monetize that locally. We used to do a better job of this when we had community banks, but community banks have been gobbled up by the large bank holding companies, and we have ever fewer locally owned and locally managed banks that do a good job of providing credit to local producers. So we have to find a way to get back to that where we can monetize the local value added in the community. These are some emergent alternatives. We have trade exchanges and private alternative currencies, which I maintain are well positioned to provide small and medium-sized enterprises and local economies with reliable credit, supplemental exchange media based on exchange of real value. And they do this by monetizing the local value added. The question often arises, if we're going to talk about local currencies or local exchange systems, who is qualified to issue a currency? One of my mentors, I never met him because he died before I ever got involved in researching money and banking. His name was E.C. Riegel. He had tremendous insights into the nature of money and how it works or doesn't work. And he said that only producers are qualified to issue money because they have to redeem money for their product. Any issuer of money has to be prepared to redeem the money by accepting it in payment for their own goods and services. So basically, businesses and professional service providers, they are qualified to issue a currency based on their goods and services that are in everyday demand. I'm not quite as strict as Riegel. I would admit that municipal governments are also qualified to issue a currency based on their anticipated tax revenues if their issuance is not excessive. And likewise, you can take associations of all of these businesses and governmental entities that are qualified to issue a local currency. The requirements for a sound exchange system or currency are the currency or credit, and I lump these together because credit can take the form of a currency or it can be simply on a ledger on a computer somewhere. So a sound basis for issuing credit or currency is the first requirement. Secondly, there has to be an adequate rate of reflux or return to the issuer. The issuer can't just keep putting currency out. He has to be redeeming it on a regular basis by accepting it in payment for goods and services. A system of local exchange also requires competent, honest, and transparent management. There needs to be timely disclosure of all the pertinent information. The system also has to have adequate revenues to cover operating costs. And many of the local currencies that have popped up over recent years have been volunteer managed and have not had adequate revenues to pay people to do the work. So you end up with volunteer burnout. We also need effective oversight and participation by the members and users. This is something that we haven't been too good at. You know, we're accustomed to a market economy. We just want to go into the market and find a provider who has what we want, give them money, and buy it. But we need to begin to take responsibility for our cooperatively owned and managed enterprises and make sure that we hold the managers that we appoint, hold them to account. Mutual credit is the fundamental approach that I am advising these days, and here's the way it works. You form an association called a Mutual Credit Clearing Association, represented by this oval, and then you have members of two kinds. I've distinguished issuing members from non-issuing members. Now, the difference between an issuing member excuse me, and a non-issuing member is that an issuing member is one who can have a negative balance. That is, they can spend before they earn. It's like having a line of credit at your bank. If you overdraw your account, the bank will make it up. In a mutual credit clearing system, you have to have someone in the negative in order for someone else to be in the positive. Because the way this works is a member who has the issuance privilege buys something with credit. So the seller is advancing credit to the buyer. So an issuing member who has an overdraft privilege will buy something from another member. That other member will receive a credit. The buyer will receive a debit. So accounts will fluctuate up and down as people buy and sell. This isn't just pie in the sky. It's not a harebrained idea. It's something that's been done over and over again throughout history. And one of the best models we have to look at currently is the Veer Business Circle Cooperative. This is a Swiss enterprise. It has demonstrated the power of direct credit clearing between buyers and sellers, both in terms of financial crisis and in normal times. It's demonstrated its competitive superiority to conventional money and banking. I visited the Veer in Basel, Switzerland in 2005 and had extensive conversations with a professor who had been on their advisory board for a number of years. And he wrote a book which we had translated into English, which you can download from the web. You'll find a link to it on my blog, beyondmoney.net. But anyway, the Veer was started in the Great Depression in 1934, and it has been thriving for that whole time. Currently, they have 60,000 business members conducting $2 billion worth of transactions annually. Now, this is a business-to-business clearing exchange. During the Depression, when there was an insufficient supply of conventional money in circulation, the small and medium-sized businesses came together to figure out how they could continue to do business with one another in spite of the monetary scarcity. So they formed this credit clearing association where they simply extended each other credit on a collective basis that enabled cashless trading. We also have seen over the last four decades the emergence of commercial barter exchanges, more appropriately called trade exchanges. And there are dozens of these around the country and around the world. They have a trade association called IRTA, which stands for International Reciprocal Trade Association. I have spoken twice at their annual convention, most recently in October of this year. And some of the for-profit businesses that provide this cashless trading opportunity are ITEX, IMS, Turk Barter, and others that you see there. So they're referring to their business now as the modern trade and barter industry. And in 2008, there were about 250,000 North American businesses that were members of one or another of these companies, and they transacted $16 billion worth of trades during that year. About $11 billion of that was involving small and medium-sized businesses. One of these companies saw a growth of 40% in new membership last year and 55% in their total transactions. In Argentina, during their financial difficulties of the 1990s and early 2000s, a number of the provinces began to issue their own currencies. This one that I show from the province of Mendoza is based on petroleum royalties that the province receives. I have been proposing for local communities a five-stage regional development program. We're trying to implement this in the south of India, in the area around Auroville near Pondicherry. The first stage is to promote import substitution that I referred to earlier. And first you have to map the territory, find out who's doing business with whom, where they're sourcing their inputs, and where their markets are, whether they're selling locally or selling for export. But the big shift that we have here from conventional economic development is to provide an alternative means of payment, which is the credit clearing process that I just described. Based on that, you can also issue a regional currency that involves not only the people who are members of the exchange system, but also businesses that are in the community but not members of the exchange. At the same time, you have to develop the social capital and basic support structures. In my latest book, The End of Money and Future of Civilization, I refer to the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain. Mondragon is a cooperative of cooperatives. There are something like 120 separate industrial co-ops. They have a cooperative bank that provides financing for them. This is part of the support structure that I refer to. And finally, we have to develop and adopt at some point an independent standard and unit of account. As the purchasing power of the dollar continues to decline, we need to account for our purchases and trades in some other unit that will maintain its value. So mutual credit clearing associations and community currencies provide exchange media that are abundant, community controlled, democratically allocated, interest-free, self-adjusting, stable, and sustainable. And this results in greater local self-determination, social harmony, equity, justice, and better quality of life for all. So this is a situation in which everybody can win. There's no need to fight anyone. We don't need to take down the banking system. The good news is that Armageddon has been canceled. It's up to us, however, to build the alternative. We needn't push any new legislation through Congress. All we have to do is take responsibility for ourselves and our communities and begin to organize ourselves into exchange systems and local currency groups that can provide for better sharing and cooperation and a better quality of life for all. Thank you very much.